Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and here with his divining rod to figure out the technical problems caused by running water on the microphones is Michael Kester. We're going to solve it. We're going to solve all of the audio issues. This feels like double feature year one again.
Mm-hmm.
We're over here like, what's this sound? Where's this? Who's this noisy? Where's this coming from? We have two movies on the show today. The movies have content in them, content we will talk about. It is recommended you watch the films, but I don't know what they are.
Oh, you don't know what they are?
No, I do. I'm lying. I'm lying so that you
okay,
say it.
Cool.
That's a lie I'm telling the audience.
One of them is a film called A Bittersweet Life, which I've never seen before. And the other one is a Coen Brothers movie called The Man Who Wasn't There, which I have seen before because we have to cover it on the show. I'm just winging it on A Bittersweet Life.
You've seen A Bittersweet Life. Don't. I know you've watched this. You watched it back when we called it Tokyo Drifter, right?
Oh, that's right.
Oh.
Who
I did
picked
feel
this
a
one?
Little, hopefully not the same person who picked Tokyo Drifter, because I will come find you. I think we did that on an AC, and I don't remember a lot about that movie because I have brain problems, but I vaguely recall that it included mandatory Asian cinema showdowns in, you know, large nightclubs where people were doing deals about ambiguous things and then everybody got shot.
Mm-hmm.
There's spoilers for these movies. We're going to spoil The Man Who Wasn't There, the Coen Brothers movie. We're going to spoil A Bittersweet Life, which is Floyd's movie.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Floyd said, hey, you should check this out. And then we poked into it. We go, oh, we know this guy. We know this. Fuck, I've forgotten his name. Who did this movie? No idea. Don't remember.
No, I mean, I could guess, but it would just be racist.
Well, you have a clue that it's Asian cinema. It wouldn't be racist to guess an Asian person worked on this piece of Asian cinema.
Well, sure, it's not racist.
And you know it's not Takashi Miike because...
No, but my next go-to is Chan-Wook Park, but I know it's not him.
No, it's not. But you're getting closer. It is Ji-Won Kim.
That's right.
Who did A Tale of Two Sisters, and I Saw the Devil.
Mm-hmm.
Also did The Good, the Bad, and the Weird, which you and I constantly fight about whether or not we've done on the show before.
Mm-hmm.
And I
right.
think you're right. I think we have not done it
right.
on the show before. Again, just because your brain functions better than mine does. So
if you want us to do The Good, the Bad, and the Weird on Double Feature, patreon.com/double feature, $2, type The Good, the Bad, and the Weird in some field. This is the part where it gets vague for me. I don't know how this part works. You type The Good, the Bad, and the Weird on a thing. You send it to a person. That person converts it to binary, puts that into a computer.
Nope, you're losing it. You're losing it. But it's something like that. Yeah. If you go on the Patreon, it shows all the incentives over on the side. The biggest incentive, of course, and the people who are on there totally know this, you can tell, but it's that the show gets to keep going. So we are nearing the end of the year. We found a lot of magical stuff, and it is almost time to start billboarding the insanity that is the year-end episode. So get fucking hyped about that. But we also have listener picks that come in through there, and A Bittersweet Life is one of those. That's from Floyd. We kind of found a double feature for it. That's part of the exciting thing about recommending a movie is you get to see, you put it into the black box that is double feature and you see what other movie comes out the other side. That's sometimes really hard.
Mm-hmm.
I make it sound really simple. Like you just feed it into a machine, a great double feature is generated, but the machine is powered by two people who have to sit here and go, okay, we've never seen this movie.
And we don't want to spoil it by reading about
right.
it.
So how do we do this? But you've got kind of a cool thing today. I mean, I boiled your theme down too much when you and I talked about it. So maybe it's better that you give the more detail-oriented explanation of this.
I mean, I think today what we're looking at is it's two individuals who are basically the crux of events that are normally not even involved in events or marginally involved. You boiled it down after I explained it like that in a way more digestible way.
Well, I think the thing we're going to return to over and over is the absence of agency.
Right.
But what's lost in that, so if you haven't seen these movies yet, definitely go see them and think about that when you're watching them. Think about that these are people whose normal day-to-day responsibilities, that's the part that I like about the way you phrase this. Their day-to-day responsibilities do not include the type of thing that would move the film through the motions.
Right.
Other deals are going on. Things are happening around them. This is a movie about people who live in a world where deals are going on, whatever the fuck that phrase means.
Mm-hmm.
And when they don't perform their routine rote, when they're not on autopilot doing the thing that the man tells them to do,
mm-hmm.
you know, we love to entertain fuck the man movies here on Double Feature. This is kind of the consequences of fuck the man.
Sure.
When you go, no, I'm going to strike out. I'm going to do something different. You get to see how the giant machines that they operate within, whether it's noir society and the man who wasn't there, or the sort of, there's a better word for this, I'm sure, but essentially the mob in A Bittersweet Life, you'll see how that machine reacts to them in some pretty dramatic fucking ways. So whether we end up talking about that a lot or not, I think those are good launching points for the other things that will happen in these movies and something to look at when you watch them. And I'd like to start with A Bittersweet Life first because of doo-wop rules.
Sure, you got to.
A Bittersweet Life and The Man Who Wasn't There. That just sounds like a thing that should happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to really sell the pairing of these two movies to Floyd and make him a happy patron. So we got this guy in The Bittersweet Life. He is an enforcer. And so the construct of his life is that, you know, it's built in such a way where there's a shady illicit activity going on. And then he is, I mean, I think he's a really good enforcer. I think that's what we learn off of.
He's a very loyal enforcer, I think is also an important thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, his, you know, we see a lot of this in his performance, that he doesn't flinch. You know, that he, just in how he reacts to things and how other people react to him, I feel like that's really important to the film because his performance sells not only who he is, but kind of what he thinks about himself.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really need to be told that he's great at his job. It's just when the moments come where, okay, it's time to fuck up everybody in the room, he snaps into that. But there's also this kind of ongoing mystery. So he comes into this problem. Maybe we just look at what is the point with these two movies where there is agency.
Sure. Yeah.
Right.
And here it's probably when he chooses not to do his job. Right.
Yeah.
It's basically the best way to look at these movies is at what point does the person do the opposite thing that a person in their place would normally do?
Mm-hmm.
The other film is anytime he's not just cutting hair and being a good husband. In this film, it's the moment he decides to, I mean, man, fuck, how easy is this? It's the time somebody goes, hey, enforce, and he goes, I'm going to not enforce.
Yeah. So the movie creates a big question out of this. I feel like that's one of the main themes of the film. When you finish it, regardless of how you watch movies or what you're looking for, you kind of turn to the other person and go, okay, why did he really do that? I mean, the movie invokes this question over and over. Not just what you tell people, but the truth of the matter.
Mm-hmm.
He's sent there to basically kill this girl and her boyfriend, if it turns out that this girl has a boyfriend. And he goes in there, he fucks him up, and he doesn't kill them. And the movie sort of goes, is it because they're in love?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really know the answer to that.
Right.
Do you know the answer to
no,
that?
No, fuck no. No, no, no. I don't think you're supposed to know.
Yeah.
I think it's, to me, it's less about whether or not they're in love and more about the, it's kind of the moment where he goes, oh man, like I'm being asked to extinguish a glimmer of humanity.
Sure.
Up until this point in the movie, he's, you know, punching fucking 80s street thugs.
Yeah.
These are the first real people he's been asked to flex on. And I think he maybe goes, wait a second, I'm not trying to flex on real people. I just flex on 80s street thugs.
Well, he sees this sort of beauty in her. He sees something in her and we don't know what it is. And I think what makes that tricky to figure out is how the movie treats her. She's very much the catalyst, but it's not her story. For all intents and purposes, she's a MacGuffin in this movie. She is the thing that mob people see some glimmer of humanity in that mm-hmm. reminds them. These are all selfish guys, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that he falls in love with her because of her characteristics or how charming she is as a person or any of that. Really, we don't know. We don't know what makes this girl special at all, other than mm-hmm. guys think she's special. Our relationship with her as an audience is fucking nothing.
Right.
But we do know
that we're only left to assume that she has the golden pussy or something.
Well, that's the thing, right? Is a lot of times in a movie, you get this magic woman that floats into people's lives mm-hmm. and can just make everything better. And here I look at her like a golden briefcase. She's just mm-hmm. the fucking thing that is not only, I wouldn't even say chaste. It's not that everybody's competing for her or wants to be with her, because then I think we'd have a serious problem in the movie. We'd constantly be asking, why do these people want to be with her? But if we can accept that this is a movie about our protagonist and just our protagonist, if his conflict is the central one, then we know he sees something in her. We don't have to know what, but mm-hmm. he sees something in her that reminds him of his fucking autonomy, reminds him of his life outside of what he's doing. Basically, it reminds him that there's something else to life than just taking orders and worrying about what other people think of you.
Mm-hmm.
Because he has built this entire construct of himself, this whole, he's basically built an image of himself. So when he walks into a room and somebody accuses him of something, I think that's why he goes, I refuse to apologize. I refuse to acknowledge I'm wrong. I refuse to do this or that. Because I think if you were to look at this guy's life, the most important thing to him is how he is perceived to others.
Sure.
That he's good at his job, that he can kick everybody's
his
ass.
His honor. That you shouldn't. Yeah. Sure.
But yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. Even loyalty to some extent.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that's interesting, though, is when you put it in that terms, and we kind of have accidentally fallen backwards into this, is it's also somebody who refuses to apologize, who's incredibly proud of their work, especially when their work is physical, and who is surrounded by other individuals who like to incite violence and control a lot of things, and who all seem to be upset with the fact that the one woman in the film isn't trying to fuck them.
Mm.
Sort of highlights that this movie is heavily about the toxicity of masculinity. You know, when you look at this character who basically goes, I'd rather murder everybody and die than apologize for the one thing that I did wrong. And I don't think you're wrong. I think that, I mean, obviously the character is such that he's strongly based on being perceived as a decisive and maybe in some ways a perfect henchman. But at the same time, I feel like taking the film back one level, I don't think it's just interesting to me, because the movie basically, by the end of it, you have this conversation between him and the mob boss the question has no answer, right? In that yeah. conversation. Which leaves you as the audience to go, well, why then though?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the easiest answer is because dudes be fighting.
Well, he's at a battle with himself.
Right.
The answers to the questions don't really matter, because I think, you know, the big personal question for the audience at the end of the film that kind of determines why is, does this guy win or lose? And I feel like because this is a movie that is about him, that the movie is best looked at being as being about this character, because we follow him a lot. We learn a lot about him. We see the different beats of his path, but we don't with anybody else. So if we are to focus on this character, then we're seeing somebody who is at a, in a battle with himself. And to go back to this theme of the absence of agency, if his struggle, if his sort of flaw as a character is that he's concerned about the way other people perceive him and sort of the image of himself, he makes one, the one sort of quote unquote mistake that he makes in the movie to let these people live. The one problem, you know, he lets them live. And the problem is that there's a, he doesn't think it through. It's a terrible plan because there's a performative element to her surviving, which is that she can keep going out with the boss and pretend nothing's wrong. But when you know that your boyfriend has sent someone to murder you, then it's not going to be the same. You're not going to be able to, unless he really sits down and they hatch a plan and he coaches her into making sure that she can act her way through this. And there's just no attempt to do that. So he makes this kind of instinctive, spur of the moment decision to go, no, you know what? You know what? I'm going to do what's morally correct. For whatever reason, he does that. And probably even because of that character flaw, probably because he wants to appear to this girl. He's become invested in the time that he spent with her. You know, when he calls, when she calls him an enforcer, he kind of gets upset about it. Because in that moment, that's not how he wants to appear. He's not trying to appear super fucking hard to this girl the way he does to all the mobsters back, you know, in normal day-to-day life.
Right.
So because of this decision, he gets his ass kicked, but he has an opportunity halfway through the film where he survives his own death, essentially, and he could run away. Because if the real conflict is not the the physical day-to-day conflicts we're seeing, if we, the movie tells us that the conflict is he's getting his ass kicked, there's a girl, there's his boss, there's these forces coming to get him. And yeah, that's sort of the workday conflict. But if the actual conflict is this guy's life and how he lives it, and if he's ever going to go on to do the things that actually make him happy instead of trying to create this image, then he has the opportunity to do that when he escapes. He could leave and start a new life, maybe with this fucking girl, maybe not with this girl, but this could be enough to give him, you know, this, it's a window into, oh, what if you could be happy somewhere by not doing this and just trying to be yourself and have people really see who you are? But he doesn't. And so I think that the way I look at this movie is that he loses this battle with himself. That it's a fucking tragedy. Because by the end of the movie, he's just right back doing the same thing that he's trying to do.
Right.
It looks different. It looks like he's kicking everybody's ass that he was once loyal to. But I think the movie knows that that's essentially still the same thing. He's putting up a front for these people. And, you know, he makes that phone call at the very end to get some reminder, but I think it's a reminder of all that could have been and not, oh, I did this for you, or that's what makes this different than a normal kind of revenge movie. It's not like I was wronged and now I'm going to go out and get revenge. That's the way he plays it. And the phone call tells us, no, this was about this man's sort of fight for an independence or an opportunity to be true to himself that he basically didn't take and then got his ass kicked instead. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It makes the movie very, it's a lot more Western-like.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely has, it's funny because
The Western's always, you know, the existential crisis, the man, who is he in this changing world?
Well, but what's really amazing is when you look at mob movies in the you know, you look at Eastern movies, Eastern mob movies versus Western mob movies.
Mm-hmm.
And Western mob movies are a bunch of rich people talking cool, and then one of them kills the other one behind their back or unexpectedly. But there is no struggle in a Western mob movie. It is very much the upper hand is had from the beginning of the film, and we just try to figure out who has it as the film goes on. In an Eastern mob movie like this, or even Tokyo Drifter, or I mean, Kill Bill does a lot of this, right? It's this thing where, and if you want to see it kind of come back to the Western theme, look at Sukiyaki Western Django. We were just talking about Takashi Miike last week. There's a redemption quality to the Eastern mafia movie. It's someone has been betrayed and they will actively pursue redemption at the cost of their own life. And so it has way more of that Western quality.
You can tell that there is, Ji-Woon Kim is thinking about that, even just in how it's directed. The makeup of the movie, the tone, the way it's all standoffs, you know, it's all pregnant pauses, deep stares, and then an abrupt gunshot, and then more deep stares, and then someone falls. You know, it's shot like a fucking Western in the, not in the way we usually talk about a movie being in like super wides or whatever, but in the interpersonal dynamics. The way that there's, you know, if you were to change the backdrop to half these scenes from a neon nightclub to a fucking dusty saloon, then you're literally, you throw fucking cowboy hats on these guys and you are absolutely in a Western. I mean, what I find interesting about, here's another character dynamic that's really interesting for me to look at in the movie, and then we got to get the fuck out of here, go to the next movie. But this whole movie is knife fights. The whole movie is people who show up. I think about the scene where he has the aluminum bat and the other guy comes up to him and he goes, I don't need no fucking bat. You know, again, just more of him showing off his image to this guy and trying to represent this character that he thinks he is. And then there is a point where once he gets a gun, the whole game changes. These people are all very serious, very hard, tough guys, but they're all bringing knives to a gunfight at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So once we're in that second half of the movie or in the third act and he's got that gun that he goes and gets, it doesn't matter how hard these guys are, what fucking tough guys he is up against, he can just mow them all down. And the place that he gets that gun, they're not serious people.
Mm-hmm.
They're the least serious people in the world. They're the biggest fools in the movie, but they have the guns, so they have the upper hand. And I think it's really interesting to look at how he's surrounded with these people who are basically all about the honor of the fist fight and the presentation. And that change happens, you know, the way he's able to rise above that is when he basically goes and tricks his way into getting a weapon from these guys who are like stoners sitting around in somebody's basement who have no business in this whole mob industry. And they just happen to have the guns, and the gun at the knife fight is so much more important than any presentation anybody's putting on in this movie. It just cuts right through the facade and most people down, which I think is interesting into the themes we were talking about. Anyway, it's got a little dense there. Sorry.
No, it's fine.
Can we
just said you
about
had some top secret info about the movie where
the man is not there.
Billy Bob Thornton gets a blowing job.
Yeah. Well, so it's just this, it's this secret thing about the opening. This is a Coen movie. We've talked about Coen movies a lot. Done quite a few of them,
you know, for kids.
In fact, we're almost running out of Coen movies.
No, we're not.
No. Okay, we still have that Elvis one. Is that,
there's the Elvis one.
Can that be every time we're missing a movie from a director? It's just the Elvis one. The Coens make a lot of movies about filmmaking. A lot of filmmakers make movies about filmmaking. When you are a writer and you are deep in the, what was the Caesar movie they did? What was that called?
Hail Caesar.
Hail Caesar. Thank you. I didn't want to call it something stupid that I would.
Mm-hmm.
When you live in the world of Hail Caesar, it's very hard to write a movie about something because you write about things you know. And if you're in the film industry, you fucking write about film industry stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And even when you try not to, those are just the relationships, the dynamics, the stories that are happening in your life that are shaping stuff that's happening in your head. And there's a lot of interesting conversation that have, you know, Herzog's talked about this a lot, about how you have to go out and live life and do things that aren't film, because otherwise, what the fuck are you going to tell stories about?
Mm-hmm.
And even if you're not telling stories about filmmaking per se, they are thinly veiled, you know, stories about filmmaking. So the Coens have told a lot of stories that are actually about the film industry, and they've told stories like Hail Caesar, but we also did Barton Fink on the show, and that's just from the writing perspective, you know, a story about a guy trying to write a thing. And they cut against that a little bit in that it's sort of a story about a guy writing a thing, but it's sort of a story about something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm always interested in the way they play with these different motifs, where sometimes that the filmmaking piece weaves in and out. Sometimes it's only that on the surface, but not underneath. Anyways, the thing I get to is there just so happens to be this opening in this movie that comes from a part of the film world that I didn't know anything about when I first saw this and has become a sort of unfortunate and huge part of my life, which is financing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like between this and Demon Lover the other week,
mm-hmm.
that's a picture of the story of my life right now. It's just like having these meetings with these people and trying to figure out what investors are interested in what things and what financiers want what projects and whatever. And so we're approached in this movie. There's this guy, he's got a life as a barber, and everything's going fine, but kind of mundane, kind of dry. And then this squirrely guy shows up in his world, and the guy is just, he shows up for a haircut, and he's such a fucking character. Shows up, doesn't care that the barbershop's closed, has a sort of lack of self-awareness or doesn't give a fuck. I don't know if it's that he thinks he is above it all or what, but he sits down for a haircut anyways, as if the rules don't apply to him. He goes on to casually drop that he's got this $10,000 investing opportunity. Just so you know, I've got this thing. And then he leaves. And later, Billy Bob Thornton's character goes back to his hotel room. And you know what I find to be really interesting is that the guy doesn't even recognize him at first. So I think in the movie, this is just supposed to play like the magical G word you and I have been increasingly talking about, a grifter.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this fucking guy who's got some swindle or something. He comes into town and he's trying to take advantage of somebody. So he tells Billy Bob Thornton's character that he wants a silent partner. Essentially, he wants somebody to give him the money for this deal. And that is the inciting incident that launches everything off in this movie. That is the point we were talking about that comes well into the movie in the previous film. But this is the change in his life that's going to alter all. He's correct. He gets out of the mundane life because of this.
Right, right.
So really, this character achieves his goals.
Right.
He doesn't want a mundane life anymore. He doesn't just want to be sitting around at the barbershop. He wants to get into some trouble, which is exactly what he gets. And so this is almost a movie about somebody who wins in the end, even though, you know, the end of this movie is what it is. And I just think it's funny that I can see where this character comes from if this character is in Hail Caesar. I can see the sort of person who is kind of dubious, but it's a business proposition that shows up, even down to, you know, his character asks aloud to the audience as he's reciting this. Was he a huckster? Was this the real McCoy or whatever other film noir Double Indemnity nonsense he's throwing at us? You know, he's basically going, was this guy a grifter? Is this an opportunity for me? Maybe I should take it. And so he goes back to him to give him the money. The guy doesn't even notice who he is and then immediately puts on the character. And then he sits on the bed, undoes his tie and winks at him. I mean, especially in post-Weinstein world, like this was the moment where I went, oh, they're talking about film financing. This is what this is. This is just like some random investor who's trying to get involved in something. Anyways, it's not the premise of the entire movie, but I've seen all the Coen movies. I think I've seen all of them. And I thought I knew where all these filmmaking characters were in all the movies. And I had never noticed this one before. And I feel now, especially in the moment of just the random character beat of the guy trying to bang him, which just seems so out of line for anything else in the movie. It doesn't make sense for anything else in the movie. I go, okay, well, this is coming from people who are around this in the film world, intentional or not.
I think the other thing, too, that you have to keep in mind with what we always talk about with the Coen Brothers movie is there's always a moment where the fabric of the world that the film is set in gets lifted for the film to actually do the thing that they want to accomplish. I think back to Hudsucker Proxy when he stops falling.
The magical realism of it all.
And in a film like The Man Who Wasn't There, which is doubly firmly grounded in the mundanity of everyday life, you don't need a magic Negro to handcart into town and tell you about treasures unknown. You just need somebody from Hollywood to go into middle America and be a little queer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's enough to shake it up.
Right. Yeah.
And
the movie's full of those characters too. People who come in from out of town or who are part of they're part of a different movie that wander in.
Big city people, man. It's the movie. Yeah. This movie is about what happens when big city ideas pollute your normal, everyday, red-blooded dark gray-blooded American.
Because who else do you see in this movie?
Tony Shalhoub. You get the fast-talking lawyer who Richard Jenkins... The one of my favorite roles in this film is Richard Jenkins, who goes, yeah, I'm the town lawyer, but I'm bad.
So good.
And he goes, if you want somebody real good, you got to get somebody from a real city, a big old city, one of them big urban metropolises like Sacramento.
Well, yeah, I think it's funny. The lawyer is probably the most transparent of any of these characters that comes in and just has... is just from another fucking movie, just walks out of the set of another film.
I think that's the illusion that Anne has in the film when she goes, no, aliens came and ruined my marriage.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's an allusion to these people who have no business in this fucking town coming in and fucking with these people.
Sure.
It's like aliens walk in and go, you're being silly. You're not even happy. What if for $10,000 your whole life could be changed? Let me just cram it up your butt.
Yeah.
That's out of line. And it's really interesting because I go back and forth on Ed's level of success in this film. If his goal is to escape the mundaneness of his life, which I don't believe it is because he seems to have become complacent with it by the time the film starts.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a 1-2 punch of the opportunity to make money off of this get rich quick scheme that's too good to be true, and his budding pedophilia that makes him go, maybe my life could be different.
It's not a get rich quick scheme. It's venture capital. It's a very legitimate business.
Right. Sure.
Which is also Silicon Valley, by the way. Like this exists everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There's always these people.
And what's funny about this is, when the other foot drops in this film, you get a character who does something and gets away with it. Well, rather, I should put it a different way. he does something and then gets caught. And then by the sheer fact that he is the least likely suspect, he's the second barber. He's the second ambulance driver in this film.
Right.
He's the least likely suspect. All the rest of the dominoes around him fall in his favor.
Mm-hmm.
Wife gets taken away. She kills herself, so he doesn't even have to, you know, it's ultimately a guilt-free move there.
This is really the most Coen thing about it.
Yeah.
Is just this kind of, like, the Coens do the theme of this show today.
Yeah.
The Coens are the ones who basically go, it's just a funny world to do this theme in, because it's always this character who just has no agency, and he just tries, even when this guy attempts to have agency,
mm-hmm.
it's just the world is so much bigger than him. So he is just Mr. Magooing his way through this whole movie.
And he succeeds backwards through the entire movie, up to and including a blowjob from the person that he is probably not sexually attracted to, if I'm being honest.
Yeah. Well, that's also kind of funny, because he is now the very thing that he criticized in the beginning of the movie with the guy that I've spent all this time talking about. He is now, hey, there's this girl, a young girl. I guess I could be your manager, take some of her money, get close to her. Everybody will win. He's basically doing what the other guy with the toupee came in to do in the beginning of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And she tells him, like, I don't even want to do any of this anyways. So it's solely about himself. It has nothing to do it's a very gaslighty thing. It's this idea.
Yeah, it's that masculinity that's super present in the 1950s with somebody who's got to have a good job and a stable marriage and is really not, I mean, even when
he wants to think of himself as a good guy, and what a good guy would do is really help this young, talented girl along, never even stopping to go, oh, hey, is this what you want to do with your life?
Right.
Would you be interested in this plan?
Yeah. And when you get the other shoe dropping after the car accident, it's amazing, because this is essentially the one thing he's not guilty of doing. It's the one person that he has no hard feelings toward. Even by way of butterfly effect, I would argue that he has nothing to do with this character being killed.
Mm.
But every other patsy is dead now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the only reason he even gets accused of this crime is because literally all the other accusable people have been murdered or suicided.
Right. So there is this poetic justice, because just as the movie opens with him living in a world where his actions seem to have no, or his fate seems to have no connection to his actions, so does the movie end where his fate seems to have no connection to his actions.
Right.
Cinematically, we feel like, oh, there's justice. It's poetic. He killed somebody, and so he suffers the consequences. But the Coens are creating this world where it's just, This is the Fargo TV show a lot too. It's
mm-hmm.
just these characters who kind of, I don't want to use the word bumble because it's oversimplified, but I don't know the better word because I'm not great at having words.
Mm. You don't have the best words in our show about deals?
I just don't have the best words about deals. You can tell why we're learning so much about this. It's not just the film industry. It's America in 2019. But you see this a lot with Coens, and it says their perspective on the world and kind of on, it's almost about fate. It's almost about, look, you make the best decisions you can, you go through the world, but maybe none of us have any agency, because no matter how much you try to do a thing, outside forces will have more impact than any decision you ever make ever could.
It's very much about the role you take up in space. And both of these films are like that. These are two films about somebody who has been assigned a role in a stage play that they're involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically have one line and they can choose whether to nail it or ad lib.
Unless you get cast as the cops, because those guys have a lot of lines.
This is basically a film about extras who get a talking line.
Yeah.
And it's up to them to either deliver the line at script or to really try and make themselves the star of the show.
Well, that's what I mean. That's why I bring up the cops. That's another example of the exchange with the characters where it's just quintessentially Cohen. You know, not only are they coming from a different world, but I feel like they're actually in a different scene than he ever is.
Yeah.
You know, like when they come to deliver the news about his wife, his reaction does not match their performance.
Mm-hmm.
They're over there like, man, we got stuck with this duty. We got to tell you a thing. And look, this is just not a, I forget what they call it. Their detail. That's what they call it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What a terrible detail that we got on. And then he's having this reaction that might say a lot that they need to know as police officers about what's really happening here. But they can't see him because they're in their own fucking world, like mm-hmm. the guy from the last movie.
Well, also like the coroner at the prison who goes, "Hey, I'm gonna step outside my normal role here.
I'm gonna
really become, you know, your guy." And then he goes, "Maybe you should have stayed in your lane." He goes, "Oh, I mean, I don't know. I'm just gonna stay in my lane on this one, I think."
Yeah, I love to see these characters who think the movie's about them. And that's, right. We see that over and over again. Just, they think the movie is about how they're police and they're doing whatever they were doing in their version of the movie. But then their captain, who doesn't like them or whatever, made them go talk to this dude. And they totally lose what is the most relevant, important thing in their day, which is like, hello, the actual murder and the dude who did it is right here. And that's a Coen movie. That's it. That's how it goes. People call this a film noir, but I think it's like Night of the Hunter. You remember Night of the Hunter?
It's the scariest movie ever made.
Yeah. So go back and watch this and think about Night of the Hunter. That'll be a nice
mm-hmm.
other thought pattern to go down that we don't even have time for. We got to get out of here. I want to thank Abbott of Unreason, Ben Acker, Billy Wilson, Brett Hayton, Bruno Hunziker, Mark Abbott, Tom Leonard, John, and
Charles Crawfish.
Correctly pronounced Crawford, all executive producers of the show, and more importantly, patrons of the show. That's patreon.com/double feature. Because of that very Patreon website, we have scrapped together enough to do the show next time.
Next time on Double Feature, we're going to do, I don't know, maybe these are hard too. I'm not going to spoil too much, but something's going to blink in one of these two movies, and it's not going to be what you want to blink. Just what I'm going to, it's going to make no sense to you now.
What a weird tease.
But wait, we're going to do a film called The Changeling, does not star Angelina Jolie. It's a film from 1980, and Clint Eastwood was, as far as I know, not involved.
Changeling, we're going, like the double feature Changeling, not like what what the fuck any other show would do, the one we'd do.
And we're going to pair that with a movie that seems to be based on something, but makes no goddamn sense, called Gothic from 1986. It's vaguely about the true and actual, based on the truth and lies events of Mary Shelley writing the novel Frankenstein.
So fitting, truth and lies.
Once again, I implore that you watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.